Siddhartha by Hermann Hesse, read by Derek Jacobi.
In the shade of the house, in the sunshine on the river bank by the boats, in the shade of the sallow wood and the fig tree, Siddhartha, the handsome Brahmin's son, grew up with his friend Govinda. The sun browned his slender shoulders on the river bank while bathing at the holy ablutions, at the holy sacrifices. Shadows passed across his eyes in the mango grove during play, while his mother sang, during his father's teachings when with the learned men. Siddhartha had already long taken part in the learned men's conversations, had engaged in debate with Govinda, and had practiced the art of contemplation and meditation with him. Already he knew how to pronounce Om silently, this word of words, to say it inwardly with the intake of breath, when breathing out with all his soul, his brow radiating the glow of pure spirit. Already he knew how to recognize Atman within the depth of his being, indestructible, at one with the universe. There was happiness in his father's heart because of his son, who was intelligent and thirsty for knowledge. He saw him growing up to be a great learned man, a priest, a prince among Brahmins. There was pride in his mother's breast when she saw him walking, sitting down, and rising. Siddhartha, strong, handsome, supple-limbed, greeting her with complete grace. Love stirred in the hearts of the young Brahmin's daughters when Siddhartha walked through the streets of the town with his lofty brow, his king-like eyes, and slim figure. Govinda, his friend, a Brahmin's son, loved him more than anybody else. He loved Siddhartha's eyes and clear voice. He loved the way he walked, his complete grace of movement. He loved everything that Siddhartha did and said, and above all, he loved his intellect, his fine ardent thoughts, his strong will, his high vocation. Govinda knew that Siddhartha would not become an ordinary Brahmin, a lazy, sacrificial official, an avaricious dealer in magic sayings, a conceited, worthless orator, a wicked, sly priest, or just a good, stupid sheep amongst a large herd. No, and he, Govinda, did not want to become any of these, not a Brahmin like 10,000 others of their kind. He wanted to follow Siddhartha, the beloved, the magnificent. And if he ever became a god, if he ever entered the all-radiant, then Govinda wanted to follow him as his friend, his companion, his servant, his lance-bearer, his shadow. That was how everybody loved Siddhartha. He delighted and made everybody happy. But Siddhartha was not happy. He had begun to feel that the love of his father and mother, and also the love of his friend Govinda, would not always make him happy, give him peace, satisfy and suffice him. He had begun to suspect that his worthy father and his other teachers, the wise Brahmins, had already passed on to him the bulk and best of their wisdom. Yet his intellect was not satisfied. His soul was not at peace. His heart was not still. The ablutions were good, but they were water. They did not wash sins away. They did not relieve the distressed heart. The sacrifices and the supplication of the gods were excellent. But were they everything? Did the sacrifices give happiness? Were not the god forms created, like me and you, mortal, transient? Was it a sensible and worthy act to offer sacrifices to the gods? To whom else should one offer sacrifices? To whom else should one pay honour but to him, Atman, the only one? And where was Atman to be found? Where did he dwell? Where did his eternal heart beat? If not within the self, in the innermost, in the eternal which each person carried within him. But where was this self, this innermost? It was not flesh and bone. It was not thought or consciousness. That was what the wise men taught. Where then was it? To press towards the self, towards Atman, was there another way that was worth seeking? Nobody showed the way. Nobody knew it. Neither his father, nor the teachers and wise men, nor the holy songs. The Brahmins and their holy books knew everything, everything. They had gone into everything. The creation of the world, the origin of speech, food, inhalation, exhalation, the arrangement of the sense, the acts of the gods. They knew a tremendous number of things. But was it worthwhile knowing all these things, if they did not know the one important thing, the only important thing? No. This tremendous amount of knowledge, collected and preserved by successive generations of wise Brahmins, could not be easily overlooked. But where were the Brahmins, the priests, the wise men, who were successful not only in having this most profound knowledge, but in experiencing it? Where were the initiated, who, attaining Atman in sleep, could retain it in consciousness, in life, everywhere, in speech and action? Siddhartha knew many worthy Brahmins, above all his father. Holy, learned, and of highest esteem, his father was worthy of admiration. His manner was quiet and noble. He lived a good life. His words were wise. Fine and noble thoughts dwelt in his head. But even he, who knew so much, did he live in bliss? Was he at peace? Was he not also a seeker, insatiable? Did he not go continually to the holy springs with an insatiable thirst, to the sacrifices, to books, to the Brahmins' discourses? Why must he, the blameless one, wash away his sins and endeavour to cleanse himself anew each day? Was Atman then not within him? Was not then the source within his own heart? One must find the source within one's own self. One must possess it. Everything else was seeking, a detour, error. These were Siddhartha's thoughts. This was his thirst, his sorrow. It often seemed near the heavenly world, but never had he quite reached it, never had he quenched the final thirst. And among the wise men that he knew and whose teachings he enjoyed, there was not one who had entirely reached it, the heavenly world, not one who had completely quenched the eternal thirst. Some Samanas passed through Siddhartha's town, wandering ascetics. They were three thin, worn-out men, neither old nor young, with dusty and bleeding shoulders, practically naked, scorched by the sun, solitary, strange, and hostile. Lean jackals in the world of men. Around them hovered an atmosphere of still passion, of devastating service, of unpitying self-denial. In the evening, after the hour of contemplation, Siddhartha said to Govinda, "Tomorrow morning, my friend, Siddhartha is going to join the Samanas. He is going to become a Samana." Govinda realized, from the first glance at his friend's face, that now it was beginning. Siddhartha was going his own way. His destiny was beginning to unfold itself, and with his destiny, his own. And he became as pale as a dried banana skin. "Oh, Siddhartha," he cried, "will your father permit it?" Siddhartha looked at him like one who had just awakened. As quick as lightning he read Govinda's soul, read the anxiety, the resignation. "We will not waste words, Govinda," he said softly. "Tomorrow at daybreak I will begin the life of the Samanas. Let us not discuss it again." Siddhartha went into the room where his father was sitting on a mat made of bast. He went up behind his father and remained standing there until his father felt his presence.
"Is it you, Siddhartha?" the Brahmin asked. "Then speak, what is in your mind?"
Siddhartha said, "With your permission, father, I have come to tell you that I wish to leave your house tomorrow and join the ascetics. I wish to become a Samana. I trust my father will not object." The Brahmin was silent so long that the stars passed across the small window and changed their design before the silence in the room was finally broken. His son stood silent and motionless with his arms folded. The father, silent and motionless, sat on the mat, and the stars passed across the sky. Then the father said,
"It is not seemly for Brahmins to utter forceful and angry words, but there is displeasure in my heart. I should not like to hear you make this request a second time."
The Brahmin rose slowly. Siddhartha remained silent with folded arms.
Why are you waiting? Asked his father.
You know why, answered Siddhartha. His father left the room displeased and lay down on his bed. As an hour passed by and he could not sleep, the Brahmin rose, wandered up and down, and then left the house. He looked through the small window of the room and saw Siddhartha standing there with his arms folded, unmoving. He could see his pale robe shimmering. His heart troubled, the father returned to his bed. As another hour passed and the Brahmin could not sleep, he rose again, walked up and down, left the house and saw the moon had risen. He looked through the window. Siddhartha stood there, unmoving, his arms folded. The moon shone on his bare shin bones. His heart troubled, the father went to bed. He returned again after an hour, and again after 2 hours, looked through the window and saw Siddhartha standing there in the moonlight, in the starlight, in the dark. And he came silently again, hour after hour, looked into the room and saw him standing, unmoving. His heart filled with anger, with anxiety, with fear, with sorrow. And in the last hour of the night, before daybreak, he returned again, entered the room, and saw the youth standing there. He seemed tall and a stranger to him.
Siddhartha, he said, why are you waiting?
You know why.
Will you go on standing and waiting until it is day, noon, evening?
I will stand and wait.
You will grow tired, Siddhartha.
I will grow tired.
You will fall asleep, Siddhartha.
I will not fall asleep.
You will die, Siddhartha.
I will die.
And would you rather die than obey your father?
Siddhartha has always obeyed his father.
So you will give up your project?
Siddhartha will do what his father tells him. The first light of day entered the room. The Brahmin saw that Siddhartha's knees trembled slightly, but there was no trembling in Siddhartha's face. His eyes looked far away.
Then the father realized that Siddhartha could no longer remain with him at home,
that he had already left him.
The father touched Siddhartha's shoulder. You will go into the forest, he said, and become a Samana. If you find bliss in the forest, come back and teach it to me. If you find disillusionment, come back, and we shall again offer sacrifices to the gods together. Now go. Kiss your mother, and tell her where you are going. For me, however, it is time to go to the river and perform the first ablution.
He dropped his hand from his son's shoulder and went out. Siddhartha swayed as he tried to walk. He controlled himself, bowed to his father, and went to his mother to do what had been told to him. As he slowly left the still sleeping town at daybreak, a crouching shadow emerged from the last hut and joined the pilgrim. It was Govinda. You have come, said Siddhartha, and smiled. I have come, said Govinda.
On the evening of that day, they overtook the Samanas and requested their company and allegiance. They were accepted. Siddhartha gave his clothes to a poor Brahmin on the road and only retained his loincloth and earth-coloured, unstitched cloak. He only ate once a day and never cooked food. He fasted 14 days. He fasted 28 days. The flesh disappeared from his legs and cheeks. Strange dreams were reflected in his enlarged eyes. The nails grew long on his thin fingers, and a dry, bristly beard appeared on his chin. His glance became icy when he encountered women. His lips curled with contempt when he passed through a town of well-dressed people. He saw businessmen trading, princes going to the hunt, mourners weeping over their dead, prostitutes offering themselves, doctors attending the sick, priests deciding the day for sowing, lovers making love, mothers soothing their children. And all were not worth a passing glance. Everything lied, stank of lies. They were all illusions of sense, happiness, and beauty. All were doomed to decay. The world tasted bitter. Life was pain. Silently, Siddhartha stood in the fierce sun's rays, filled with pain and thirst, and stood until he no longer felt pain and thirst. Silently, he stood in the rain, water dripping from his hair onto his freezing shoulders, onto his freezing hips and legs, and he stood until his shoulders and legs no longer froze, till they were silent, till they were still. Silently he crouched among the thorns. Blood dripped from his smarting skin. Ulcers formed, and Siddhartha remained stiff, motionless, till no more blood flowed, till there was no more pricking and no more smarting. Siddhartha sat upright and learned to save his breath, to manage with little breathing, to hold his breath. He learned, while breathing in, to quiet his heartbeat, learned to lessen his heartbeat until there were few and hardly any more. Instructed by the eldest of the Samanas, Siddhartha practiced self-denial and meditation according to the Samana rules. A heron flew over the bamboo wood, and Siddhartha took the heron into his soul, flew over forest and mountains, became a heron, ate fishes, suffered heron hunger, used heron language, died a heron's death. A dead jackal lay on the sandy shore, and Siddhartha's soul slipped into its corpse. He became a dead jackal, lay on the shore, swelled, stank, decayed, was dismembered by hyenas, was picked at by vultures, became a skeleton, became dust, mingled with the atmosphere. And Siddhartha's soul returned, died, decayed, turned into dust, experienced the troubled course of the life cycle. Siddhartha learned a great deal from the Samanas. He learned many ways of losing the self. He travelled along the path of self-denial through pain, through voluntary suffering and conquering of pain, through hunger, thirst, and fatigue. He travelled the way of self-denial through meditation, through the emptying of the mind of all images. He lost his self 1,000 times, and for days on end he dwelt in non-being. But although the path took him away from self, in the end they always led back to it. Although Siddhartha fled from the self 1,000 times, dwelt in nothing, dwelt in animal and stone, the return was inevitable. The hour was inevitable when he would again find himself in sunshine or in moonlight, in shadow or in rain, and he was again self and Siddhartha. At his side lived Govinda, his shadow. He travelled along the same path, made the same endeavours. They rarely conversed with each other, apart from the necessities of their service and practices. Sometimes they went together through the villages in order to beg food for themselves and their teachers. "What do you think, Govinda?" Siddhartha asked at the beginning of one of these expeditions. "Do you think we are any further? Have we reached our goal?" Govinda replied, "We have learned, and we are still learning. You will become a great Samana, Siddhartha. You have learned each exercise quickly. The old Samanas have often praised you. Some day you will be a holy man." Siddhartha said, "It does not appear so to me, my friend. What I have so far learned from the Samanas, I could have learned more quickly and easily in every inn, in a prostitute's quarter, among the carriers and dice players." Govinda said, "Siddhartha is joking. How could you have learned meditation, holding of the breath, and insensibility towards hunger and pain with those wretches?" Then Siddhartha said, softly, as if speaking to himself, "What is meditation? What is abandonment of the body? It is a temporary escape from the torment of self. The driver of oxen makes this same flight when he drinks a few bowls of rice wine or coconut milk in the inn. He then no longer feels his self, no longer feels the pain of life. He then experiences temporary escape. Falling asleep over his bowl of rice wine, he finds what Siddhartha and Govinda find when they escape from their bodies by long exercises and dwell in the non-self." Govinda said, "But Siddhartha is no driver of oxen, and a Samana is no drunkard. The drinker does indeed find escape, but he returns from the illusion and finds everything as it was before. He has not grown wiser, he has not gained knowledge, he has not climbed any higher." Siddhartha answered with a smile on his face, "I do not know. I have never been a drunkard, but I, Siddhartha, only find a short respite in my exercises and meditation, and am as remote from wisdom, from salvation, as a child in the womb. That, Govinda, I do know.
On another occasion, when Siddhartha left the wood with Govinda in order to beg for food for their brothers and teachers, Siddhartha began to speak.
Well, Govinda, are we on the right road? Are we gaining knowledge? Are we approaching salvation? Or are we perhaps going in circles? We, who thought to escape from the cycle.
We have learned much, Siddhartha, Govinda said. There still remains much to learn. We are not going in circles, we are going upwards. The path is a spiral. We have already climbed many steps.
Siddhartha replied, How old do you think is our oldest Samana, our worthy teacher?
Govinda said,
I think the eldest would be about 60 years old.
And Siddhartha said, He is 60 years old, and he has not attained Nirvana. He will be 70 and 80 years old, and you and I, we shall grow as old as he, and do exercises, and fast, and meditate, but we will not attain Nirvana, neither he nor we. Govinda, I believe that amongst all the Samanas, probably not even one will attain Nirvana. We find consolations, we learn tricks with which we deceive ourselves, but the essential thing, the way, we do not find.
Do not utter such dreadful words, Siddhartha, said Govinda. How could it be that amongst so many learned men, so many seekers, so many devoted to the inner life, so many holy men, none will find the right way?
Siddhartha, however, said in a soft, somewhat sad, somewhat jesting voice, Soon, Govinda, your friend will leave the path of the Samanas, along which he has travelled with you for so long. I suffer thirst, Govinda, and on this long Samana path my thirst has not grown less. I have always thirsted for knowledge. I have always been full of questions. Year after year I have questioned the Brahmins. Year after year I have questioned the holy Vedas. Perhaps, Govinda, it would have been equally good, equally clever and holy, if I had questioned the rhinoceros or the chimpanzee. I have spent a long time, and have not yet finished, in order to learn this, Govinda, that one can learn nothing. There is, so I believe, in the essence of everything, something that we cannot call learning. There is, my friend, only Atman, that is in me, and you, and in every creature, and I am beginning to believe that this knowledge has no worse enemy than the man of knowledge.
Thereupon Govinda stood still on the path, raised his hands, and said,
Siddhartha, do not distress your friend with such talk. Truly, your words trouble me. Think, what meaning would our holy prayers have, the venerableness of the Brahmins, the holiness of the Samanas, if, as you say, there is no learning? Siddhartha, what would become of everything? What would be holy on earth? What would be precious and sacred?
Siddhartha was silent.
When both youths had lived with the Samanas about 3 years and shared their practices, they heard from many sources a rumor, a report. Someone had appeared called Gautama, the illustrious, the Buddha. He had conquered in himself the sorrows of the world and had brought to a standstill the cycle of rebirth. He wandered through the country preaching, surrounded by disciples, having no possessions, homeless, without a wife, wearing the yellow cloak of an ascetic, but with lofty brow, a holy man, and Brahmins and princes bowed before him and became his pupils. This report, this rumor, was heard and spread here and there. The Brahmins talked about it in the town, the Samanas in the forest. The name of Gautama, the Buddha, continually reached the ears of the young men, spoken of well and ill, in praise and in scorn. He possessed great knowledge, said the believers. He remembered his former lives. He had attained Nirvana and never returned on the cycle. He plunged no more into the troubled stream of forms. Many wonderful and incredible things were reported about him. He had performed wonders, had conquered the devil, had spoken with the gods.
His enemies and doubters, however, said that this Gautama was an idle fraud. He passed his days in high living, scorned the sacrifices, was unlearned, and knew neither practices nor mortification of the flesh. The rumours of the Buddha sounded attractive. There was magic in these reports. The world was sick. Life was difficult. And here there seemed new hope. Young men all over India listened, felt a longing and a hope. The rumours reached the Samanas in the forest, a little at a time, every little item heavy with hope, heavy with doubt. They spoke little about it, as the elder Samana was no friend of this rumour. He had heard that this alleged Buddha had formerly been an ascetic and had lived in the woods, had then turned to high living and the pleasures of the world, and he held no brief for this Gautama. Govinda once said to his friend, "I wish that both Siddhartha and I may live to see the day when we can hear the teachings from the lips of the Perfect One. My friend, shall we not also go hither and hear the teachings from the lips of the Buddha?" Siddhartha said, "I always thought that Govinda would remain with the Samanas. I always believed it was his goal to be 60 and 70 years old, and still practice the arts and exercises which the Samanas teach. But how little did I know Govinda! How little did I know what was in his heart! Now, my dear friend, you wish to strike a new path and go and hear the Buddha's teachings." "It gives you pleasure to mock me," Govinda said. "No matter if you do, Siddhartha, do you not also feel a longing, a desire to hear this teaching? And did you not once say to me, 'I will not travel the path of the Samanas much longer'?" Then Siddhartha laughed. "You have spoken well, Govinda." On that same day, Siddhartha informed the eldest Samana of his decision to leave him. He told the old man with the politeness and modesty fitting to young men and students. But the old man was angry that both young men wished to leave him, and he raised his voice and scolded them strongly. Govinda was taken aback, but Siddhartha put his lips to Govinda's ear and whispered, "Now I will show the old man that I have learned something from him." He stood near the Samana, his mind intent. He looked into the old man's eyes and held him with his look, hypnotized him, made him mute, conquered his will, commanded him silently to do as he wished. The old man became silent, his eyes glazed, his will crippled. His arms hung down, he was powerless under Siddhartha's spell. Siddhartha's thoughts conquered those of the Samana. He had to perform what they commanded. And so the man bowed several times, gave his blessings, and stammered his wishes for a good journey. The young man thanked him for his good wishes, returned his bow, and departed. On the way, Govinda said, "Siddhartha, you have learned more from the Samanas than I was aware. It is difficult, very difficult, to hypnotize an old Samana. In truth, if you had stayed there, you would have soon learned how to walk on water." "I have no desire to walk on water," said Siddhartha. "Let the old Samanas satisfy themselves with such arts." In the town of Savati, every child knew the name of the illustrious Buddha, and every house was ready to fill the begging bowls of Gautama's disciples. Near the town was Gautama's favourite abode, the Yatavana Grove, which a rich merchant, a great devotee of the illustrious one, had presented to him and his followers. The two young ascetics had been referred to this district by tales and answers to their questions, and on their arrival in Savati, food was offered to them immediately at the first house at whose door they stood, silently begging. Siddhartha asked the lady who handed him the food, "Good lady, we should very much like to know where the Buddha, the illustrious one, dwells. For we are two Samanas from the forest and have come to see the Perfect One and hear his teachings from his own lips." The woman said, "You have come to the right place, O Samanas from the forest. The illustrious one sojourns in Jetavana, in the garden of the merchant. You may spend the night there, pilgrims, for there is enough room for the numerous people who flock there to hear his teachings." Then Govinda rejoiced and happily said, "Ah, then we have reached our goal, and our journey is at an end. But tell us, mother of pilgrims, do you know the Buddha?
Have you seen him with your own eyes? The woman said, I have seen the illustrious one many times. On many a day I have seen him walk silently through the streets in a yellow cloak, and hold out his alms bowl at the house doors, and return to the garden with his bowl filled.
Govinda listened enchanted, and wanted to ask many more questions, and hear much more. But Siddhartha reminded him that it was time to go. They expressed their thanks and departed. It was hardly necessary to inquire the way, for quite a number of pilgrims and monks from Gautama's followers were on the way to Yatavana. When they arrived there at night, there were continual new arrivals. The two Samanas, who were used to life in the forest, quickly and quietly found shelter and stayed there till morning. At sunrise, they were astounded to see the large number of believers and curious people who had spent the night there. Monks in yellow robes wandered along all paths of the magnificent grove. Here and there they sat under the trees, lost in meditation or engaged in spirited talk. The shady gardens were like a town, swarming with bees. Most of the monks departed with their alms bowls in order to obtain food for their midday meal, the only one of the day. Even the Buddha himself went begging in the morning. The Buddha went quietly on his way, lost in thought. His peaceful countenance was neither happy nor sad, with a secret smile not unlike that of a healthy child. He walked along, peacefully, quietly. He wore his gown and walked along exactly like the other monks. But his face and his step, his peaceful downward glance, his peaceful downward hanging hand, and every finger of his hand spoke of peace, of completeness, sought nothing, imitated nothing, reflected a continuous quiet, an unfading light, an invulnerable peace. And so Gautama wandered into town to obtain alms, and the two Samanas recognized him only by his complete peacefulness of demeanor, by the stillness of his form, in which there was no seeking, no will, no effort, only light and peace.
Today we will hear the teachings from his lips, said Govinda.
Siddhartha did not reply. He was not very curious about the teachings. He did not think they would teach him anything new. But he looked attentively at Gautama's head, at his shoulders, at his feet, at his still downward-hanging hand, and it seemed to him that in every joint of every finger of his hand there was knowledge. They spoke, breathed, radiated truth. This man, this Buddha, was truly a holy man to his fingertips. Never had Siddhartha esteemed a man so much. Never had he loved a man so much. In the evening, when the heat abated and everyone in the camp was alert and gathered together, they heard the Buddha preach. They heard his voice, and this also was perfect, quiet and full of peace. Gautama talked about suffering, the origin of suffering, the way to release from suffering. Life was pain. The world was full of suffering. But the path to the release from suffering had been found. There was salvation for those who went the way of the Buddha. The illustrious one spoke in a soft but firm voice, taught the four main points, taught the eightfold path, patiently, with examples and repetition. Clearly and quietly his voice was carried to his listeners, like a light, like a star in the heavens. When Buddha had finished, it was already night, many pilgrims came forward and asked to be accepted into the community, and the Buddha accepted them and said, "You have listened well to the teachings. Join us then, and walk in bliss. Put an end to suffering." Govinda, the shy one, also stepped forward and said,
"I also wish to pay my allegiance to the illustrious one and his teachings."
He asked to be taken into the community, and was accepted. As soon as the Buddha had withdrawn for the night, Govinda turned to Siddhartha and said eagerly,
"Siddhartha, we have both listened to the illustrious one. We have both heard his teachings. Govinda has listened to the teachings and has accepted them. But you, my dear friend, will you not also tread the path of salvation?"
When he heard Govinda's words, Siddhartha awakened as if from a sleep.
He looked at Govinda's face for a long time. Then he spoke softly. Govinda, my friend, you have taken the step. You have chosen your path. You have always been my friend, Govinda. You have always gone a step behind me. Now you are a man, and have chosen your own path. May you go along it to the end, my friend. May you find salvation. In that moment, Govinda realized that his friend was leaving him, and he began to weep.
Siddhartha, he cried.
Siddhartha spoke kindly to him. Do not forget, Govinda, that you now belong to the Buddha's holy men. You have renounced home and parents. You have renounced origin and property. You have renounced your own will. You have renounced friendship. That is what the teachings preach. That is the will of the illustrious one. Tomorrow, Govinda, I will leave you. For a long time, the friends wandered through the woods. They lay down, but they could not sleep. Govinda pressed his friend again and again to tell him why he would not follow the Buddha's teachings, what flaw he found in them. But each time Siddhartha waved him off. Be at peace, Govinda. The illustrious one's teachings are very good. How could I find a flaw in them? Early in the morning, one of the Buddha's followers, one of his oldest monks, went through the garden and called to him all the new people who had sworn their allegiance to the teachings, in order to place upon them the yellow robe, and instruct them in the first teachings and duties of their order. Thereupon Govinda tore himself away, embraced the friend of his youth, and drew on the monk's robe. Siddhartha wandered through the grove, deep in thought. There he met Gotama, the illustrious one. He greeted him respectfully, and as the Buddha's expression was so full of goodness and peace, the young man plucked up courage and asked the illustrious one's permission to speak to him. Silently, the illustrious one nodded his permission. Siddhartha said, Yesterday, O illustrious one, I had the pleasure of hearing your wonderful teachings. I came from afar with my friend to hear you, and now my friend will remain with you. He has sworn allegiance to you. I, however, am continuing my pilgrimage anew. As you wish, said the illustrious one politely. My talk perhaps is too bold, continued Siddhartha, but I do not wish to leave the illustrious one without sincerely communicating to him my thoughts. Will the illustrious one hear me a little longer? Silently, the Buddha nodded his consent. Siddhartha said, Oh, illustrious one, in one thing above all have I admired your teachings. You show the world as a complete, unbroken chain, an eternal chain, linked together by cause and effect. Never has it been presented so clearly, never has it been so irrefutably demonstrated. Surely every Brahmin's heart must beat more quickly when through your teachings he looks at the world, completely coherent, without a loophole, clear as crystal, not dependent on chance, not dependent on the gods. The unity of the world, the coherence of all events, the embracing of the big and the small from the same stream, from the same law of cause, of becoming and dying. This shines clearly from your exalted teachings. But according to your teachings, this unity and logical consequence of all things is broken in one place. Through a small gap there's a world of unity, something strange, something new, something that was not there before, and that cannot be demonstrated and proved. That is your doctrine of rising above the world, of salvation. With this small gap, through this small break, however, the eternal and single world law breaks down again. Forgive me if I raise this objection. Gotama had listened quietly, motionless. The perfect one then spoke in his kind, polite, and clear voice. You have listened well to the teachings, O Brahmin son, and it is a credit to you that you have thought so deeply about them. You have found a flaw. Think well about it again. Let me warn you, you who are thirsty for knowledge, against the thicket of opinions and the conflict of words. Opinions mean nothing. They may be beautiful or ugly, clever or foolish. Anyone can embrace or reject them. The teaching which you have heard, however, is not my opinion, and its goal is not to explain the world to those who are thirsty for knowledge. Its goal is quite different. Its goal is salvation from suffering. That is what Gautama teaches, nothing else.
Oh, do not be angry with me, O illustrious one, said the young man. I have not spoken to you thus to quarrel with you about words. You are right when you say that opinions mean little. I did not doubt that you were the Buddha, that you have reached the highest goal which so many thousands of Brahmins and Brahmin sons are striving to reach. You have done so by your own seeking, through thought, through meditation, through knowledge, through enlightenment. You have learned nothing through teachings, and so I think, O illustrious one, that nobody finds salvation through teachings. To nobody, O illustrious one, can you communicate in words and teachings what happened to you in the hour of your enlightenment. The teachings of the enlightened Buddha teach much, how to live righteously, how to avoid evil. But there is one thing that this clear, worthy instruction does not contain: the secret of what the illustrious one himself experienced. That is what I thought and realized when I heard your teachings. That is why I am going on my way, not to seek another and better doctrine, for I know there is none, but to leave all doctrines and all teachers, and to reach my goal alone, or die. But I will often remember this day, O illustrious one, and this hour, when my eyes beheld a holy man.
The Buddha's eyes were lowered. His unfathomable face expressed complete equanimity. I hope you are not mistaken in your reasoning, said the illustrious one, slowly. Reach your goal. But tell me, have you seen my gathering of holy men, my many brothers who have sworn allegiance to the teachings? Do you think, O Samana, from afar, that it would be better for all these to relinquish the teachings and to return to desires and the life of the world?
That thought never occurred to me, cried Siddhartha. May they all follow the teachings. May they reach their goal. It is not for me to judge another life. I must judge for myself. We Samanas seek release from the self, O illustrious one. If I were one of your followers, I fear that I would deceive myself that I was at peace and had attained salvation, while in truth the self would continue to live and grow, for it would have been transformed into your teachings, into my allegiance and love for you and for the community of monks.
Half smiling, the Buddha looked steadily at the stranger and dismissed him with a hardly visible gesture. You are clever, O Samana, said the illustrious one. You know how to speak cleverly, my friend. Be on your guard against too much cleverness. The Buddha walked away, and his look and half-smile remained imprinted on Siddhartha's memory forever.
I have never seen a man look and smile, sit and walk like that, he thought. A man only looks and walks like that when he has conquered his self. I also will conquer myself. The Buddha has robbed me, thought Siddhartha. Yet he has given me something of greater value. He has robbed me of my friend who believed in me and who now believes in him. He was my shadow and is now Gautama's shadow. But he has given to me Siddhartha, myself.
End of side one.
As Siddhartha left the grove in which the Buddha, the perfect one, remained, in which Govinda remained, he felt that he had also left his former life behind him. As he slowly went on his way, Siddhartha realized that he was no longer a youth. He was now a man. He realized that something had left him, like the old skin that a snake sheds. something that had accompanied him right through his youth and was part of him. This was the desire to have teachers and to listen to their teachings. He had even left the last teacher he had met, the greatest and wisest teacher, the holiest, the Buddha. The thinker asked himself, "What is it that you wanted to learn from teachings and teachers? And although they taught you much, what was it they could not teach you?" "It was the self, the character and nature of which I wished to learn. I wanted to rid myself of the self, to conquer it, but I could not conquer it. I could only deceive it, could only fly from it, could only hide from it. Truly, nothing in the world has occupied my thoughts as much as the self, this riddle, that I live, that I am one, and am separated and different from everybody else, that I am Siddhartha. And about nothing in the world do I know less than about Siddhartha." The thinker, slowly going on his way, suddenly stood still. "The reason why I do not know anything about myself is due to one thing. I was afraid of myself. I was seeking Brahman, Atman. I wished to destroy myself in order to find in the unknown innermost Atman, life, the divine, the absolute. But by doing so, I lost myself on the way." Siddhartha looked up and around him. A smile crept over his face, and a strong feeling of awakening from a long dream spread right through his being. Immediately he walked on again, quickly, like a man who knows what he has to do. "Yes," he thought, breathing deeply, "I will no longer try to escape from Siddhartha. I will no longer devote my thoughts to Atman and the sorrows of the world. I will no longer mutilate and destroy myself in order to find a secret behind the ruins. I will no longer study Yoga Veda, Atharva Veda, or asceticism, or any other teachings. I will learn from myself the secret of Siddhartha." He looked around him as if seeing the world for the first time. The world was beautiful, strange and mysterious. Here was blue, here was yellow, here was green, sky and river, woods and mountains, all beautiful, all mysterious and enchanting. And in the midst of it, he, Siddhartha, the awakened one, on the way to himself. Meaning and reality were not hidden somewhere behind things. They were in them, in all of them. "How deaf and stupid I have been," he thought, walking on quickly. "When anyone reads anything which he wishes to study, he does not despise the letters and punctuation marks and call them illusion, but he studies and loves them letter by letter. But I, who wish to read the book of the world and the book of my own nature, did presume to despise the letters and signs. I called the world of appearances illusion. I called my eyes and tongue chance. Now it is over. I have awakened." But as these thoughts passed through Siddhartha's mind, he suddenly stood still, as if a snake lay in his path. Then, suddenly, this also was clear to him. He, who was, in fact, like one who had awakened or was newly born, must begin his life completely afresh. When he left the grove of the illustrious one, already awakened, it was his intention, and it seemed the natural course for him after the years of his asceticism, to return to his home and his father. Now, however, in that moment as he stood still, this thought also came to him. "I am no longer what I was. I am no longer an ascetic, no longer a priest, no longer a Brahmin. What then shall I do at home with my father? Study? Offer sacrifices? Practice meditation? All this is over for me now." Siddhartha stood still, and for a moment an icy chill stole over him. He shivered inwardly like a small animal, like a bird or a hare, when he realized how alone he was. He had been homeless for years and had not felt like this. Previously, when in deepest meditation, he was still his father's son. He was a Brahmin of highest standing, a religious man. Now, he was only Siddhartha, the awakened. He breathed in deeply, and for a moment he shuddered.
Nobody was so alone as he. Govinda had become a monk, and thousands of monks were his brothers, wore the same gown, shared his beliefs, and spoke his language. But he, Siddhartha, where did he belong? Whose life would he share? Whose language would he speak? At that moment, when the world around him melted away, he was overwhelmed by a feeling of icy despair, but he was more firmly himself than ever. That was the last shudder of his awakening, the last pains. Immediately he moved on again, and began to walk quickly and impatiently, no longer homewards, no longer to his father, no longer looking backwards. Siddhartha learned something new on every step of his path. He saw the sun rise over forest and mountains and set over the distant palm shore. At night he saw the stars in the heavens and the sickle-shaped moon floating like a boat in the blue. He saw trees, stars, animals, clouds, rainbows, rocks, weeds, flowers, brook and river, the sparkle of dew on bushes in the morning, distant high mountains, pale and blue. Birds sang, bees hummed, the wind blew gently across the rice fields. All this, coloured and in a thousand different forms, had always been there, but in previous times all this had been nothing to Siddhartha, but a fleeting and elusive veil before his eyes, regarded with distrust. All this was condemned to be disregarded and ostracised from the thoughts, because it was not reality. Because reality lay on the other side of the visible. But now his eyes lingered on this side. He saw and recognized the visible, and he sought his place in this world. The world was beautiful when looked at in this way, without any seeking, so simple, so childlike. The days and nights were short, every hour passed quickly, like a sail on the sea, beneath the sail of a ship of treasures, full of joy. Siddhartha saw a group of monkeys in the depths of the forest, moving about high in the branches, and heard their wild, eager cries. Siddhartha saw a ram follow a sheep, and mate. In a lake of rushes he saw the pike making chase in evening hunger. Swarms of young fishes, fluttering and glistening, moved anxiously away from it. Strength and desire were reflected in the swiftly moving whirls of water formed by the raging pursuer. All this had always been, and he had never seen it. Now he was present and belonged to it. On the way, Siddhartha remembered all that he had experienced in the gardens of Yatavana, the teachings that he had heard there from the holy Buddha, the parting from Govinda, and the conversation with the illustrious one. He remembered each word that he had said to the illustrious one, and he was astonished that he had said things which he did not then really know. What he had said to the Buddha, that the Buddha's wisdom and secret were not teachable, that it was inexpressible and incommunicable, was just what he now set off to experience. He must gain experience himself. He had known for a long time that his self was Atman, of the same eternal nature as Brahman, but he had never really found his self, because he had wanted to trap it in the net of thoughts. The body was certainly not the self, nor the play of senses, nor thought, nor understanding, nor acquired wisdom or art. Both thought and the senses were fine things. Behind both of them lay hidden the last meaning. It was worthwhile listening to them both, to play with them both, neither to despise nor overrate either of them. He would strive after whatever the inward voice commanded him. That was good. That was necessary. Nothing else was necessary. That night, Siddhartha slept in a ferryman's straw hut. As the day began, Siddhartha asked his host, the ferryman, to take him across the river. The ferryman took him across on his bamboo raft. The broad sheet of water glimmered pink in the light of the morning. "It is a beautiful river," he said to his companion.
"Yes," said the ferryman, "it is a very beautiful river. I love it above everything. I've often listened to it, gazed at it, and I've always learned something from it. One can learn much from a river.
Thank you, good man, said Siddhartha as he landed on the other side. I am afraid I have no gift to give you, nor any payment. I am homeless, a Brahmin's son, and a Samana.
I could see that, said the ferryman, and I did not expect any payment or gift from you. You will give it to me some other time.
Do you think so? Asked Siddhartha merrily.
Certainly. I have learned that from the river, too. Everything comes back. You too, Samana, will come back. Now, farewell. May your friendship be my payment.
At midday, Siddhartha passed through a village. Children danced about in the lane in front of the clay huts. They played with pumpkin stones and mussels. They shouted and wrestled with each other, but ran away timidly when the strange Samana appeared. At the end of the village, the path went alongside a brook, and at the edge of the brook, a young woman was washing clothes. When Siddhartha greeted her, she raised her head and looked at him with a smile. He called across a benediction, as is customary among travellers, and asked how far the road still was to the large town. Thereupon she stood up and came towards him, her moist lips gleaming attractively in her young face. She exchanged light remarks with him, asked him if he had yet eaten, and whether it was true that the Samanas slept alone in the forest at night, and were not allowed to have any women with them. She then placed her left foot on his right, and made a gesture, such as a woman makes when she invites a man to the enjoyment of love. Siddhartha felt his blood kindle. He stooped a little towards the woman, and kissed the brown tip of her breast. Looking up, he saw her face, smiling, full of desire, and her half-closed eyes pleading with longing. Siddhartha also felt a longing, and the stir of sex in him. But as he had never yet touched a woman, he hesitated a moment, although his hands were ready to seize her. At that moment he heard his inward voice, and the voice said, "No." Then all the magic disappeared from the young woman's smiling face. He saw nothing but the ardent glance of a passionate young woman. Gently he stroked her cheek, and quickly disappeared into the bamboo wood. Before the evening of that day he reached a large town, and he was glad because he had a desire to be with people. He had lived in the woods for a long time, and the ferryman's straw hut in which he had slept the previous night was the first roof he had had over him for a long time. Outside the town, by a beautiful unfenced grove, the wanderer met a small train of men and women servants loaded with baskets. In the middle, in an ornamented sedan chair carried by four people, sat a woman, the mistress, on red cushions beneath a coloured awning. Siddhartha stood still at the entrance to the grove and watched the procession. He looked at the sedan chair and the lady in it. Beneath heaped-up black hair he saw a bright, very sweet, very clever face. A bright red mouth like a freshly cut fig. Artful eyebrows painted in a high arch. Dark eyes, clever and observant, and a clear, slender neck above her green and gold gown. The woman's hands were firm and smooth, long and slender, with broad gold bangles on her wrists. Siddhartha saw how beautiful she was, and his heart rejoiced. He bowed low as the sedan chair passed close by him, and raising himself again, gazed at the bright fair face, and for a moment into the clever arched eyes, and inhaled the fragrance of a perfume which he did not recognize. For a moment the beautiful woman nodded and smiled, then disappeared into the grove, followed by her servants. And so, thought Siddhartha, I enter this town under a lucky star. He felt the urge to enter the grove immediately, but he thought it over. I am still a Samana, still an ascetic and a beggar. I cannot remain one. I cannot enter the grove like this. And he laughed. He inquired from the first people that he met about the grove and the woman's name, and learned that it was the grove of Kamala, the well-known courtesan, and that besides the grove she owned a house in town. Then he entered the town,
wandered about in the maze of streets, stood still in places, and rested on the stone steps to the river. Towards evening, he made friends with a barber's assistant, whom he had seen working in the shade of an arch. During the night, he slept among the boats on the river, and early in the morning, before the first customers arrived in the shop, he had his beard shaved off by the barber's assistant. He also had his hair combed and rubbed with fine oil. Then he went to bathe in the river. When the beautiful Kamala was approaching her grove, late in the afternoon, in her sedan chair, Siddhartha was at the entrance. He bowed and received the courtesan's greeting. He beckoned the servant who was the last in the procession and asked him to announce to his mistress that a young Brahmin desired to speak to her. After a time, the servant returned, asked Siddhartha to follow him, conducted him silently into a pavilion where Kamala lay on a couch, and left him. "Did you not stand outside yesterday and greet me?" asked Kamala. "Yes, indeed, I saw you yesterday and greeted you. But did you not have a beard and long hair yesterday, and dust in your hair?" "You have observed well. You have seen Siddhartha, the Brahmin's son, who left his home in order to become a Samana, and who was a Samana for 3 years. Now, however, I have left that path and have come to this town, and the first person I met before I reached the town was you. I have come here to tell you, O Kamala, that you are the first woman to whom Siddhartha has spoken without lowered eyes. Never again will I lower my eyes when I meet a beautiful woman." Kamala smiled and played with her fan made of peacock's feathers and asked, "Is that all that Siddhartha has come to tell me?" "I have come to tell you this and to thank you because you are so beautiful. And if it does not displease you, Kamala, I would like to ask you to be my friend and teacher, for I do not know anything of the art of which you are mistress." Thereupon Kamala laughed aloud. "It has never been my experience that a Samana from the woods should come to me and desire to learn from me. Many young men come to me, including Brahmin sons, but they come to me in fine clothes, in fine shoes. There is scent in their hair and money in their purses. That is how these young men come to me, O Samana." Siddhartha said, "I am already beginning to learn from you. Already I have got rid of my beard. I have combed and oiled my hair. There is not much more that is lacking, most excellent lady. Fine clothes, fine shoes, and money in my purse. Siddhartha has undertaken to achieve more difficult things than these trifles, and has attained them. Why should I not come to be your friend and to learn the pleasures of love from you? I have learned more difficult things than what you have to teach me. So Siddhartha is not good enough for you as he is, with oil in his hair, but without clothes, shoes, and money." Kamala laughed and said, "No, he is not yet good enough. He must have fine clothes and fine shoes and plenty of money in his purse and presents for Kamala. Do you understand, Samana from the woods?" Siddhartha cried, "How could I fail to understand when it comes from such a mouth? Your mouth is like a freshly cut fig, Kamala. My lips are also red and fresh, and will fit yours very well, you will see. But tell me, fair Kamala, are you not at all afraid of the Samana from the forest who has come to learn about love?" "Why should I be afraid of a stupid Samana from the forest, who comes from the jackals and does not know anything about women?"
"Oh, the Samana is strong and afraid of nothing. He could force you, fair maiden. He could rob you. He could hurt you."
"No, Samana, I am not afraid. Has a Samana or a Brahmin ever feared that someone could come and strike him and rob him of his knowledge or his piety? No, because they belong to himself, and he can only give of them if he wishes. That is exactly how it is with Kamala and with the pleasures of love. Fair and red are Kamala's lips, but try to kiss them against Kamala's will, and not one drop of sweetness will you obtain from them, although they know well how to give sweetness. You are an apt pupil, Siddhartha, so learn also this. One can beg, buy, be presented with, and find love in the streets. But it can never be stolen.
Siddhartha bowed and smiled. You are right, Kamala. No drops of sweetness must be lost from your lips, nor from mine. So Siddhartha will come again when he has what he is lacking in, clothes, shoes, money. But tell me, fair Kamala, can you not give me a little advice?
Advice? Why not? Who would not willingly give advice to a poor, ignorant Samana?
Dear Kamala, where can I go in order to obtain these three things as quickly as possible?
My friend, many people want to know that. You must do what you have learned and obtain money, clothes, and shoes for it. A poor man cannot obtain money otherwise.
I can think, I can wait, I can fast.
Nothing else?
Nothing.
Oh, yes, I can compose poetry. Will you give me a kiss for a poem? I will do so, if your poem pleases me.
After thinking a moment, Siddhartha recited this verse.
Into her grove went the fair Kamala. At the entrance to the grove stood the brown Samana. As he saw the lotus flower, deeply he bowed. Smiling, acknowledged Kamala. Better, thought the young Samana, to make sacrifices to the fair Kamala than to offer sacrifices to the gods.
Kamala clapped her hands loudly, so that the golden bangles tinkled.
Your poetry is very good, brown Samana, and truly there is nothing to lose if I give you a kiss for it.
She drew him to her with her eyes. He put his face against hers, placed his lips against hers. Kamala kissed him deeply. And to Siddhartha's great astonishment, he felt how she mastered him, repulsed him, lured him, and how, after this long kiss, a long series of other kisses, all different, awaited him. He stood still, breathing deeply.
Your poetry is very good, said Kamala. If I were rich, I would give you money for it. But it will be hard for you to earn as much money as you want with poetry, for you will need much money if you want to be Kamala's friend.
How you can kiss Kamala, stammered Siddhartha.
Yes, indeed. That is why I am not lacking in clothes, shoes, bangles, and all sorts of pretty things. But what are you going to do? Cannot you do anything else besides think fast and compose poetry?
I also know the sacrificial songs, said Siddhartha. I also know incantations.
Wait, interrupted Kamala. You can read and write?
Certainly I can. Many people can do that.
Not most people. I cannot. It is very good that you know how to read and write.
At that point a servant entered and whispered something in his mistress's ear.
I have a visitor, said Kamala. Hurry and disappear, Siddhartha. Nobody must see you here. I will see you again tomorrow.
Contentedly, he returned to the town. He stood at the door of an inn where travellers met, silently begged for food, and accepted a piece of rice cake. Perhaps tomorrow, he thought, I will not need to beg for food. He had long since inquired about Kamala's townhouse, and called there the next day.
Things are going well, she called across to him. Kamaswami expects you to call on him. He is the richest merchant in town. If you please him, he will take you into his service. Be clever, brown Samana. I had your name mentioned to him through others. Be friendly towards him. He is very powerful. But do not be too modest. I do not want you to be his servant, but his equal. Otherwise, I shall not be pleased with you. Kamaswami is beginning to grow old and indolent. If you please him, he will place great confidence in you.
Siddhartha thanked her and laughed. And when she learned that he had not eaten that day, nor the previous day, she ordered bread and fruit to be brought to him and attended him.
You have been lucky, she said to him on parting. One door after the other is being opened to you. How does that come about? Have you a charm?
Yesterday I told you I knew how to think, to wait, and to fast. But you did not consider these useful. But you will see that they are very useful, Kamala. Yesterday I kissed Kamala,
And soon I will be a merchant and have money and all those things which you value.
Quite, she agreed. But where would you be if Kamala did not help you?
My dear Kamala, said Siddhartha, when I came to you in your grove, I made the first step. It was my intention to learn about love from the most beautiful woman. I knew that you would help me. I knew it from your first glance at the entrance to the grove.
And if I had not wanted?
But you did want. Listen, Kamala, when you throw a stone into the water, it finds the quickest way to the bottom of the water. It is the same when Siddhartha has a goal. Siddhartha does nothing. He waits, he thinks, he fasts, but he goes through the affairs of the world like the stone through the water, without doing anything. He is drawn by his goal, for he does not allow anything to enter his mind which opposes his goal. That is what Siddhartha learned from the Samanas. It is what fools call magic, and what they think is caused by demons. Nothing is caused by demons. There are no demons. Everyone can perform magic. Everyone can reach his goal if he can think, wait, and fast. Kamala listened to him. She loved his voice. She loved the look in his eye. Perhaps it is as you say, my friend, she said softly. And perhaps it is also because Siddhartha is a handsome man, because his glance pleases women, that he is lucky. Siddhartha kissed her and said goodbye. May it be so, my teacher. May my glance always please you. May good fortune always come to me from you. Siddhartha went to see Kamaswami the merchant and was shown into a rich house. Servants conducted him across costly carpets to a room where he waited for the master of the house. Kamaswami came in, a supple, lively man with graying hair, with clever, prudent eyes and a sensual mouth. Master and visitor greeted each other in a friendly manner. I've been told, the merchant began, that you are a Brahmin, but that you seek service with a merchant. Are you then in need, Brahmin, that you seek service?
No, replied Siddhartha. I have never been in need. I have come from the Samanas, with whom I lived a long time.
If you come from the Samanas, how is it that you are not in need? Are not all the Samanas completely without possession?
I possess nothing, said Siddhartha, if that is what you mean, but of my own free will. So I am not in need.
But how will you live if you are without possessions?
I have been without possessions for nearly 3 years,
and I have never thought on what I should live. So you have lived on the possessions of others?
Apparently. The merchant also lives on the possessions of others.
Well spoken. But he does not take from others for nothing. He gives his goods in exchange.
That seems to be the way of things. Everyone takes, everyone gives. Life is like that.
Ah, but if you are without possessions, how can you give?
Everyone gives what he has.
The soldier gives strength, the merchant goods, the teacher instruction, the farmer rice, the fisherman fish. Very well. And what can you give?
I can think, I can wait, I can fast.
Is that all?
I think that is all.
And of what use are they? For example, fasting, what good is that?
It is of great value, sir. If a man has nothing to eat, fasting is the most intelligent thing he can do. If, for instance, Siddhartha had not learned to fast, he would have had to seek some kind of work today, either with you or elsewhere, for hunger would have driven him. But as it is, Siddhartha can ward off hunger for a long time and laugh at it.
You are right, Samana. Wait a moment.
Kamaswami went out and returned with a roll, which he handed to his guest and inquired, Can you read this?
Siddhartha looked at the roll on which a sales agreement was written and began to read the contents. Excellent, said Kamaswami. And will you write something for me on this sheet?
He gave him a sheet and a pen, and Siddhartha wrote something and returned the sheet.
You write very well, the merchant praised him. We shall have plenty to discuss, but today I invite you to be my guest and to live in my house.
Siddhartha thanked him and accepted.
He now lived in the merchant's house. Clothes and shoes were brought to him, and a servant prepared him a bath daily. Splendid meals were served twice a day, but Siddhartha only ate once a day, and neither ate meat nor drank wine. Kamaswami talked to him about his business, showed him goods and warehouses and accounts. Siddhartha learned many new things. He heard much and said little. Remembering Kamala's words, he was never servile to the merchant, but compelled him to treat him as an equal, and even more than his equal. Kamaswami conducted his business with care and often with passion, but Siddhartha regarded it all as a game, the rules of which he endeavoured to learn well, but which did not stir his heart. Daily he visited the beautiful Kamala, in handsome clothes, in fine shoes, and soon he also bought her presents. He learned many things from her wise lips. Her smooth, gentle hand taught him many things. He was taught by her that one cannot have pleasure without giving it, and that every gesture, every caress, every touch, every glance, every single part of the body has its secret which can give pleasure to one who can understand. She taught him that lovers should not separate from each other after making love without admiring each other, so that no feeling of satiation or desolation arises, nor the horrid feeling of misusing or having been misused. He spent wonderful hours with the clever, beautiful courtesan and became her pupil, her lover, her friend. Here with Kamala lay the value and meaning of his present life, not in Kamaswami's business. The merchant passed on to him the writing of important letters and orders, and grew accustomed to conferring with him about all important affairs. He soon saw that Siddhartha understood little about rice and wool, shipping and trade, but that he had a happy knack, and surpassed the merchant in calmness and equanimity, and in the art of listening, and making a good impression on strange people. If he made a profit, he accepted it calmly. If he suffered a loss, he laughed and said, "Oh, well, this transaction has gone badly." Siddhartha's sympathy and curiosity lay only with people. Although he found it easy to speak to everyone, to live with everyone, to learn from everyone, he was very conscious of something which separated him from them, and this was due to the fact that he had been a Samana. He saw people living in a childish or animal-like way, which he both loved and despised. He saw them toiling, saw them suffer and grow grey about things that to him did not seem worth the price. He saw them scold and hurt each other. He saw them lament over pains at which the Samana laughs, and suffer at deprivations which a Samana does not feel. He accepted all that people brought to him. The merchant who brought him linen for sale was welcome, as was the debtor who sought a loan, or the beggar who stayed an hour telling him the story of his poverty, and who was yet not as poor as any Samana. He did not treat the rich foreign merchant differently from the servant who shaved him, and the peddlers, from whom he bought bananas and let himself be robbed of small coins. If Kamaswami came to him and told him his troubles, or reproached him about a transaction, he listened, curiously and attentively, was amazed at him, tried to understand him, conceded to him a little when it seemed necessary, and turned away from him to the next one who wanted him. And many people came to Siddhartha, to trade with him, to deceive him, to listen to him, to elicit his sympathy, and listen to his advice. At times he heard within him a soft, gentle voice, which reminded him quietly, complained quietly, so that he could hardly hear it. Then he suddenly saw clearly that he was leading a strange life, that he was doing many things that were only a game, but that real life was flowing past him and did not touch him. His real self wandered elsewhere, far away, and had nothing to do with his life. He was sometimes afraid of these thoughts, and wished that he could also share the people's childish daily affairs with intensity, to take part instead of only being there as an onlooker. He visited the beautiful Kamala regularly, learned the art of love, in which, more than anything else, giving and taking became one. He talked to her, learned from her, gave her advice, received advice. She understood him better than Govinda had once done. Once he said to her, "You are like me. You are different from other people. You are Kamala and no one else. And within you there is a stillness and sanctuary to which you can retreat at any time and be yourself, just as I can. Few people have that capacity, and yet everyone could have it." "Not all people are clever," said Kamala.
It has nothing to do with that, Kamala. Kamaswami is just as clever as I am, and yet he has no sanctuary. Others have it who are only children in understanding. Most people, Kamala, are like a falling leaf that drifts and turns in the air, flutters and falls to the ground. But a few others are like stars, which travel one defined path. No wind reaches them. They have within themselves their guide and path. Among all the wise men, of whom I know many, there was one who was perfect in this respect. He is Gautama, the illustrious one who preaches this gospel. Thousands of young men hear his teachings every day and follow his instructions every hour, but they are all falling leaves. They have not the wisdom and guide within themselves. Kamala looked at him and smiled. You are talking about him again, she said. Again you have Samana thoughts. Siddhartha was silent, and they played the game of love. Her body was as supple as a jaguar and a hunter's bow. She played with Siddhartha for a long time, repulsed him, overwhelmed him, conquered him, rejoiced at her mastery, until he was overcome and lay exhausted at her side. The courtesan bent over him and looked long at his face, into his eyes that had grown tired. You are the best lover that I have had, she said thoughtfully. You have learned my art well, Siddhartha. Some day, when I am older, I will have a child by you. And yet, my dear, you have remained a Samana. You do not really love me. You love nobody. Is not that true?
Maybe, said Siddhartha wearily. I am like you. You cannot love either. Otherwise, how could you practice love as an art? Perhaps people like us cannot love. Ordinary people can.
That is their secret.
For a long time, Siddhartha had lived the life of the world without belonging to it. His senses, which he had deadened during his ardent Samana years, were again awakened. He had tasted riches, passion, and power. But for a long time he remained a Samana in his heart. Clever Kamala had recognized this. His life was always directed by the art of thinking, waiting, and fasting. The people of the world were still alien to him, just as he was apart from them. The years passed by. Enveloped by comfortable circumstances, Siddhartha hardly noticed their passing. He had become rich. He had long possessed a house of his own and his own servants, and a garden at the outskirts of the town by the river. People liked him. They came to him if they wanted money or advice. However, with the exception of Kamala, he had no close friends. That glorious, exalted awakening which he had once experienced in his youth, in the days after Gautama's preaching, that alert expectation, that pride of standing alone without teachers and doctrines, that eager readiness to hear the divine voice within his own heart, had gradually become a memory. Siddhartha had learned how to transact business affairs, to exercise power over people, to amuse himself with women. He had learned to wear fine clothes, to command servants, to bathe in sweet-smelling waters. He had learned to eat sweet and carefully prepared foods, also fish and meat and fowl, spices and dainties, and to drink wine, which made him lazy and forgetful. He had learned to play dice and chess, to watch dancers, to be carried in sedan chairs, to sleep on a soft bed. But he had always felt different from and superior to the others. He had always watched them a little scornfully, with that disdain which a Samana always feels towards people of the world. But slowly and imperceptibly, with the passing of the seasons, his mockery and feeling of superiority diminished. Gradually, along with his growing riches, Siddhartha himself acquired some of the characteristics of the ordinary people, some of their childishness and some of their anxiety. And yet, the more he became like them, the more he envied them. He envied them the one thing he lacked, the sense of importance with which they lived their lives, the depth of their pleasures and sorrows, the anxious but sweet happiness of their continual power to love. These people were always in love with themselves, with their children, with honour, with money, with plans or hope. But he did not learn these childlike pleasures and follies from them. He only learned the unpleasant things.
His face was still more clever and intellectual than other people's, but he rarely laughed, and gradually his face assumed the expressions which are so often found among rich people, the expressions of discontent, sickliness, displeasure, idleness, or lovelessness. Slowly, the soul sickness of the rich crept over him. Property, possessions, and riches had finally trapped him. They were no longer a game and a toy. They had become a chain and a burden. When he stopped being a Samana in his heart, Siddhartha began to play dice for money and jewels with increasing fervor, a game in which he had previously, smilingly and indulgently, taken part as a custom of the ordinary people. He was a formidable player. Few dared play with him, for his stakes were so high and reckless. He played the game as a heartfelt need. In no other way could he show more clearly and mockingly his contempt for riches, the false deity of businessmen. So he staked high and unsparingly, hating himself, mocking himself. He won thousands. He threw thousands away, lost money, jewels, a country house, won again, lost again. He loved that anxiety which he experienced during the game of dice. In this feeling alone did he experience some kind of happiness, some kind of excitement in the midst of his satiated, tepid, insipid existence. And after every great loss, he devoted himself to the procurement of new riches, went eagerly after business and pressed his debtors for payment, for he wanted to play again. Siddhartha became impatient at losses. He lost his patience with slow-paying debtors. He was no longer kind-hearted to beggars. He no longer had the desire to give gifts and loans to the poor. He, who staked 10,000 on the throw of the dice and laughed, became more hard and mean in business and sometimes dreamt of money at night. And whenever he awakened from this hateful spell, when he saw his face reflected in the mirror, grown older and uglier, whenever shame and nausea overtook him, he fled again to a new game of chance, fled in confusion to passion, to wine, and from there back again to the urge for acquiring and hoarding wealth. He wore himself out in this senseless cycle, became old and sick.
End of side 2.